It all sell back.
Ready.
Oh, okay.
Senate Agriculture and Veterans Committee will come to order. We're going to move right along because quite a bit to do in a short length of time. And we're going to start out with diversification of the Minnesota cropping system. And starting, we'll go right down the list. Welcome to the committee, and I need your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Linda Meschke. Chairman Senator Vickerman, Senator Scogin, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to speak to you today about third crops, where we are with third crops today, and where we feel Minnesota can be as an industry in the future. My name is Linda Meschke, as I said, and I'm president of a nonprofit based in Fairmont, Minnesota, working on issues related to agriculture, the environment, and rural communities. During the past 20 years, I have worked with water quality issues in South Central Minnesota. Most of my work in this area has been around agricultural non-point source pollution issues, including sediment, nitrogen, phosphorus, and pathogens, and was focused towards implementation and getting changes on the land to improve water quality. During the 13 years I was involved with the Blue Earth River Base Initiative, we put over $4.5 million of dollars of typical cost-share water quality improvement practices on the landscape in South Central Minnesota. These practices resulted in approximately 9% reduction in pollution loading from the Blue Earth River system to the Minnesota River system. While these practices were effective and resulted in improvements, we are still a long ways from meeting our water quality goals. To meet our local and state water quality goals requires about a 40% pollution reduction. We were able to reduce 9% over 13 years. We do not have 40 or 50 years to meet our water quality goals, because the TMDL deadlines are a 13-year framework. As a result of this information, I was trying to figure out how we could be more effective in our implementation and came to the conclusion that we needed to go to a higher level with our best management practices if we were going to be successful with meeting local and state environmental goals. Third crops are a higher level BMP, or best management practice. Strategically placed in the landscape, they can help us reach our water quality goals plus provide other economic and community benefits within a reasonable time frame. Working with the faculty at the University of Minnesota in 2002, we submitted an LCMR request and were funded for work around third crops and the water quality benefits. That funding, along with other funding we have received, has helped place third crops on the landscape, evaluated the water quality benefits, and provided a variety of outreach and educational programming around third crops. Third crops were developed to include a variety of crops other than corn or soybeans. Valid examples include wheat, rye, cover crops, canola, native plants for seed or bioenergy production, hybrid poplars, hazelnuts, or perennial flax or sunflower. Today, representatives from several of these crop areas will speak more specifically about these crops and the potential they have for Minnesota. Third crops are a higher-level BMP that, when targeted to environmentally sensitive areas of the landscape, can provide a multifunctional landscape that provides a systemic approach to the many challenges from agricultural non-point source pollution and results in benefits to the landowner, the local community, and the state. These working agricultural landscapes provide economic return back to the farm family and are not land retirement. These landscapes have powerful capacities to provide ecological services and conserve resources, while also producing marketable agricultural commodities using a broad palette of both perennial and annual plant species to diversify landscapes. The secret is to put the right plants in the right place, targeting diversification to the small portions of the agricultural landscape that are unsuited to industrialized annual agriculture and which are responsible for most of the environmental degradation caused by row crop agriculture. Several studies of agricultural landscapes have shown that 60 to 80% of discharges of nutrients and soil sediment may result from unsuitable land use in only 5 to 10% of these landscapes. Minnesota has a strong history of being leaders in the development of major agricultural crops raised in the state today. For example, many prominent public soybean varieties were developed by research conducted at the University of Minnesota and played a key role in the overall development of the soybean industry that we know today. It started with a state investment in a scientist to breed, test, and release soybean varieties. The story is similar for corn, wheat, oats, barley, and a variety of forage and turf species. All of these are agricultural crops that are now major economic engines in our Minnesota economy. Unfortunately, over the last 15 years, the state has not invested in the breeding and development of alternative crops. The University of Minnesota has maintained highly active breeding programs for corn, soybeans, wheat, and small grains, and leads the nation in several areas. However, the state has not invested effectively in the development of breeding programs for alternative crops. The interest in third crops over the past decade and the national stage for bioenergy crops, local foods, and the derivatives from crops indicate that it's time for the state to once again make an investment in germplasm development for alternative crops. A base investment and a commitment over a 10-year period would greatly accelerate and elevate Minnesota's position in advancing industries based on alternative crops within the state. Thank you. I'm just going to introduce the next speakers as they come. Next, we have Jeff Jensen, and he's going to talk about hazelnuts.
Chairman Vickerman, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to come and visit with you about hazelnuts in Minnesota. I'll be brief. Hazelnuts in Minnesota have huge potential as a viable third crop. Ecologically, they can provide many of the services like increased carbon sequestration, reduce soil erosion, thus reduce nutrients loading to our waterways. They also have immense potential economically. If we use Oregon as an example, they have a $44 million farm gate price for hazelnuts that they've averaged over the last 4 years. Hazelnuts have immense opportunity for rural development as well. We have the need for rural processing centers, for harvesting and processing equipment to be manufactured and utilized. And we also have the use of value-added food products. Some of the challenges that we have with hybrid hazelnuts include development of superior plants, need for uniform plants so that we can develop processing and husking technologies, development of production practices, as well as the environmental impact of hazelnut production in the state. Currently, hazelnuts are being grown by over 30 growers, ranging from a few seedlings to over 10,000 plants. There is less than 5,000 pounds of actual production. We do expect this to increase to over 10,000 pounds in the next 2 years. To put this in perspective, this would represent 0.1% of the U.S. domestic production. Recently, the Minnesota Hazelnut Producers Council was formed. This is a nonprofit group that's dedicated to the goal of developing a commercial hazelnut industry in Minnesota and throughout the greater Midwest. By working with various partners, including University of Minnesota, Oregon State University, Rutgers University, as well as Badger Set Research Corporation, we hope to take on some of these challenges and develop the commercial hazelnut industry in the state. If I could back up to Badger Set Research Corporation for just a moment, they are based in Minnesota, and they have developed hybrid hazelnuts that are a combination of the American hazel, beaked hazel, and the European hazel. They have the resistance to eastern filbert blight, which is a fungal disease that currently decimates the European variety. They provide moderate yields, good nut size, and again, are resistant to EFB. It appears that hybrid hazelnuts from Badger Set Research Corporation have the potential to be the base level for a breeding program in the state, working with, again, partners from Rutgers, Ohio State University, and the University of Minnesota. We do need significant support to help get us from where we are to where we'd like to be, as hazelnuts being a commercial industry in the state. Thank you.
I have a question, dude. From my own knowledge, do they go in a 3-4 foot bush or?
Yes, sir. These are hybrid plants. They're not trees. They would be bushes, roughly 10 to 12 feet high, 8 feet in circumference when fully developed. And this would take approximately 5 to 7 years.
And then, sir, how do you harvest them, by hand or by?
Yes, Chairman. Currently, they are harvested by hand. There have been several attempts to, through mechanization, a modified blueberry harvester has been tested, and it has worked to a degree. As you can imagine, if I can just give you an analogy, we're at the status now where if you have a row of hazelnuts, the genetic diversity is so great, each individual plant would be different. So if we were to go to a cornfield and we had a row of corn, every single plant would be different from its structure and size to how much it yields. So we really need to tackle this uniformity issue so that we can then move to the level of mechanized planting and harvesting.
And I see in your book here that you could use at other places in prime farmland. It's selling for $6,000 and $7,000 an acre where I live. So you'd have to have a lot of hazelnuts to make money at that. But you can use these on other slopes or other areas.
Correct. They are a good crop for marginal lands. They have a wide array of soils that can be grown on, from sands to heavy clays. And so they do have adaptability to many, many different types of ground. So certainly one of the easiest ways to get them on the landscape would be to put them in these marginal areas.
Senator Score, you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just curious, after you asked about harvesting, don't they shake nut trees out in California?
Some they do, indeed. Keep in mind that in Oregon, where much of the production occurs, they have hazelnuts that form on the tree, and they actually fall to the ground. And so the ground beneath the trees is kept very bare and black so that they can essentially sweep them up into rows and then come and collect them.
Oh.
We have a somewhat larger challenge in that we have nut clusters, and typically we need to harvest those nut clusters with the nuts in the cluster before the critters get to them, whether it's the squirrels or the deer or the animals there. So, again, we are high in harvesting, but there is some technology that's very promising once we can get to this uniformity.
Well, then you harvest them. Do you have to dry them? Or?
They would need to be dried. They would also need to be processed, sized, cracked, to remove the kernel from the shell. And then, of course, they could go on to any of the food products used in confections, candies, oil, certainly. And then they do have quite a bit of potential for renewable energy, biodiesel specifically.
Any other questions? Thank you. Let's hear from your next.
Okay, next we have Garth Cass, and he's with the Minnesota Native Wildflower Native Grass Growers Association.
Mr. Chairman, I too want to thank you for allowing me to participate in this hearing today. I own a 2,000-acre native grass seed production farm in near Fertile, Minnesota, in the northwestern part of the state. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Native Wildflower and Grass Producers Association. Just to give you a brief overview, I guess that's what I'm intending to do here, and it's outlined on pages 5 and 6 of your handout, but a brief overview of the industry. There's probably approximately 25 growers of native seed in the state of Minnesota, cultivating in excess of 150 different species of native plants. We estimate that the industry is responsible for about $7 to $10 million worth of seed sales per year. The primary market over the years for our products has been to the Conservation Reserve Program, although natives are just becoming, quite sought after for other purposes, one of which being bioenergy. And there's a fair amount of research that is currently being done, and more needs to be done. I think one of the things that we're facing as an industry beyond biomass would be the seed genetic transfer zones. And we've seen some legislation last year, actually, in the state of Minnesota that addressed some of those issues. And I guess further research is needed to study those issues, those genetic transfer zone issues. Again, I think it is a growing industry in Minnesota, one that we've seen good progress in, and I think it's a viable third crop opportunity for the state. And I think if there's opportunities that come in front of you, I would appreciate your consideration. So thank you.
Where is Fertile? Northern Minnesota?
Northwestern Minnesota. Senator Skoy would
mind. My district.
Skoy, can you tell me where it is?
It's kind of between Detroit Lakes and Crookston, I suppose, maybe would be.
The reason I asked that question, I wanted to know if it was cold country or halfway warm country. More cold than warm?
Mr. Chair, it might be a little colder than where you live, but Northern Minnesota wouldn't be a lot different.
I know that I put in some crepe, and I bought seed from Cottonwood, but he didn't raise it in Cottonwood. He must have got it from someplace else.
Well, yeah, and if I may, that's one of the issues, I mean, is how far do we move this material genetically? Do we move it 100 miles, 200 miles, 500 miles, and what's acceptable? And I think there needs to be more research done, because this is going to be an expanding issue as we use this material more.
Now, you brought up a subject that's important to me, trying to figure out how to do ethanol out of, not with corn, with switchgrass. How fast will this regenerate? If we go in there and cut off 30, 40 acres, will it, is it gone for a year or two, or did it come right back?
Switchgrass?
Just grass, any kind of
grass.
Yeah,
if you cut it out, I mean, if you harvest it late in the fall, I mean, you'll have, you can have annual cropping. I mean, you can have it every, it's a perennial. It'll come back the next year. You can harvest it the next year. There's no reduction in the biomass after you harvest it. You get one cutting a year.
Any other questions? No, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Right, next we have Carmen Fernholz from Madison, Minnesota.
Senator, or Chairman Vickerman and Senate Ag Committee, certainly appreciate the opportunity to also speak to you. I'm probably not speaking about an industry here, but I'm talking about cover crops in existing agricultural entities. In organics, we probably have a lot of crops in our rotation already. In fact, on my 450-acre farm, over a period of 5 or 6 years, I'll plant 6 to 7 different crops. What we're looking at is something that we can think about in terms of organics, and that is no-till organics. And we're also looking at the possibility of working with the conventional operators where they can provide a cover for their corn and soybean crops and also enhance that acreage with some of these cover crops that are leguminous. And so we're looking at using these cover crops to help abate erosion, and especially in western Minnesota, wind erosion that we know out there, that when it snows sideways instead of straight up and down. And but what we really need, if we're really looking at the no-till organic research, is cover crops that we can plant in the fall, but they will, in our more northern climates, mature earlier in the spring. Currently, when we have rye and hairy vetch, their maturity comes at a point usually early June, and we're starting to push the edge of whether we can plant corn or soybeans. But if we can get a crop that matures in mid to late May, the practice that we would do is we roll those crops down with a roller. It's a 10-foot roller approximately. That'll do 4. You can get wider rolls. Rolls the crop down, kills the crop, and in one move across the field behind there, you have a no-till planter that plants corn or soybeans right in that rolled-down crop. So you get away without any tillage, and you get away without any, or at least minimum, herbicide needs in that crop. We're just in the early stages of working with that here in Minnesota, but I think we see a lot of potential in developing the crops that we can probably mature earlier, and crops that probably have greater leaf mass so that we actually get a greater percentage of coverage of the ground. I just wanted to give you that quick picture of what it would look like in conventional cropping systems.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoggin.
Do you practice this to some degree now, or?
Chairman Vickerman, Senator Scoggin. At this point, we don't. In fact, here in Minnesota, we really have gotten made aware of this through the Rodale Institute out in Pennsylvania, who have been doing this for the last 5 years. And last summer, we had this the person from Rodale come out and speak to us. And as a result of that, we have purchased 2 rollers, one for the research station at Lamberton and one for Rosemont. And we're going to, we planted the cover crops last fall already. So this spring, we're going to do the rolling there at the station. And it's a practice that before we really want to go out and push it on to producers, we want to know what does and doesn't work. But it does appear to have some pretty good results based on what we've seen at the Rodale. But their climate is just a touch different than ours, too, so we want to make sure that we're more acclimated to Minnesota.
Any other questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman.
Next, we'll have Greg Johnson with the University of Minnesota Southern Research and Outreach Center at Waseca.
Chairman Vickerman, rest of the committee. My area of research has to deal a lot with the woody species, and that's the topic I'd like to read a brief statement on. The incorporation of woody crops into Minnesota farming systems has the potential to provide biomass for renewable energy sectors, generate high-value bio-based products, and improve economic vitality in rural sector, in rural communities. These multiple benefits will be most readily obtained from an integrated biomass production system that's based on perennial crops planted at strategic areas of the landscape, close to processing centers. But in order to take advantage of this potential, we need to support the development of reliable, high-productivity germplasm. It's critically important. The economic prospects for woody perennial systems are improving as the technology for cellulosic energy progresses. There are several examples of this already throughout the state of Minnesota. For example, the Central Minnesota Ethanol Cooperative in Little Falls. We've got Roar Malting in Shakopee and the Virginia Hibbing Public Utilities up in northern Minnesota. But these are examples of an expanding bioindustrial sector in Minnesota. So there's a need to ensure that these initiatives, these bio-based businesses, have the sufficient woody feedstocks available at a reasonable cost. Currently, we're targeting two primary woody species for biomass production. They're the hybrid poplar and the hybrid willow. These two species grow extremely well in Minnesota, produce an enormous amount of biomass. They meet industry requirements and have properties that can help address environmental and ecological challenges. We are currently evaluating a limited number of genetic lines of these high-producing woody biomass species in Minnesota. We're working to develop production strategies that will fit with the soils and climate of Minnesota, as well as reducing establishment costs associated with willow and poplar production that will result in overall increases in productivity. We're also conducting some trials dealing with some other woody species, primarily alders, and looking at some native willow plantations as well. There's an interesting project that's going to be coming on this spring, trying to deal with again, these alder species, trying to look at the genetic, the winter hardiness, productivity, fermentable sugar yields, and these sorts of plants. So that's kind of interesting there. Just to briefly summarize, in order for third crops to become economically sustainable, we need to be able to provide industry with a custom-grown feedstock that meets very specific requirements set by a given end use. By providing a custom-grown product, farmers and industrial partners will both benefit. Furthermore, a site-specific approach to biomass crop placement is critical. We hope to develop knowledge-based decision tools that can be used by farmers and other land managers to design cropping systems that meet market demands for food, fiber, biomass, as well as optimizing profitability, but addressing some of these critical environmental issues as well. But the key to the success of these efforts has to be a very robust program in germplasm development and improvement. This will guarantee us very high rates of productivity, and guarantee that we'll have a product that's adapted to our diverse climates in Minnesota with the characteristic that, that industry requires. Thank you.
Any questions? Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're to the end of the testifiers here, and I'd just like to say to the committee, you know, as a farmer who grows a minor use crop, how important it is for the university to be providing, you know, good funding for these crops, because there's no way that they can start because they have no mass. And, you know, as we move toward private research or even private funding or private matches of the University of Minnesota funding, it's extremely difficult for these crops to get started. And, you know, they don't have the marketing of a product to have a checkoff yet or anything like that. So, you know, if the university is listening to this, or certainly for us members, that when we are looking at university funding, we really need to make sure that these small crops have the mechanism to get funding and to get plot work and to get partial part of the pathology and the soils and agronomy that they need to get started. And I'm real glad to see these groups here today. I think one of the testifiers said it, you know, this is how the soybean started, and look what we have out of that. So real real glad you guys are here today testifying on this.
Senator Scogin?
Mr. Chair, just a comment before we hear from our final testifier today. These people today aren't testifying on any particular bill, but our final witness came to me about a year ago and asked if there was an opportunity for this committee to hear some of the stories about some of the third cropping opportunities that are out there. And I just want to thank you for giving them that time today. And I think Senator Scoy hit the nail on the head. We need to hear them. We talk about these kinds of things a lot and how we're going to get there. These are some people that think about it a lot more than we do. We need to support them in some ways. So with that, Don, I know, wants to finish up the testimony, and I just wanted to thank the committee for taking the time to hear them today.
Thank you very much, Senator Vickerman, committee members. Yes, we do appreciate the opportunity to bring some of the things that are kind of out in the shadows. There are a lot of folks that are working on some very creative ideas, and I thought it was at least an opportunity for this group to present some of the creative work that is underway across the state trying to build new agricultural enterprises. And as we all know, soybeans didn't happen overnight. It took a substantial amount of public investment, and I think that the ideas that we've brought in front of you are not that they're all going to be successful. We've had failures in the past, but I think there's a unique opportunity to create a multifunctional agriculture that provides continuous living cover at the landscape level, that produces economic opportunity as well as ecosystem services. The area that I've been spending some time on is this whole area of perennial grains. You know, as we talk about the landscape, we talk about producing oil. Two species that were out there and we didn't pay much attention to was the old perennial sunflowers and the old perennial flax. Why would we consider those two? Well, they both produce high-quality oils. And if developed into perennial species, could provide that continuous living cover, reduce the need to till each year, and provide yields over a number of years. So I have taken on almost as a hobby project with the USDA group in Fargo to try and do the early stage studies as to whether it was possible. We're now getting to the point where it does now appear that you can produce a perennial sunflower with a nice seed head and it overwinters. So obviously we have a ways to go, but I think it again brings forward some options that we have not allowed ourselves to consider. And as we've moved to annual cropping systems, these perennials, these potential perennial species basically, at least in my world of research, have been ignored. And if we're going to move any of them forward in the future, there needs to be some level of, I would argue, public investment, because what we're talking about here, these are common goods that can come out of this type of plant material. With that, I thank you.
I think most of us here remember the old flax piles. I remember them easily. Stacks and stacks of flax down in at least my country. And I think a lot of it was for the oil base for paint. I think that's what it was, some of it.
That's correct.
Yes.
You could come with me down where I live, and I don't think I could find the flax field. I don't know where it would be. So, you know, it's funny how things come around, and then they come back around again. So I think we're right, Senator Scogin?
Mr. Weiss, just a couple things. I asked your group to be brief, and I appreciate that you were.
Thank you. You
kept it in the half-hour time limit. I had my doubts, but I appreciated that.
We promised.
Just for the public record, in your opinion, if you could speak for the group, how can the government or public policy best help you today?
Chairman, Senator, as I look at these ideas that the citizens and faculty have presented, I think that it could be looked at just as the model we talked about in terms of soybeans. We didn't dump a tremendous amount, millions of dollars per year in the development of soybeans. We put a limited amount of resources on the table. Remember, it's biology. It takes time to develop these crosses and to evaluate those crosses over time. So I would argue that we could, in fact, follow that same model. And it could be a modest investment. For example, $100,000 in each of these areas for a period of 10 years. And I think that we would be able to move new capital. This is, we watch soybeans bring in tremendous capital into the state. I think these examples, and there are other examples. You know, obviously, we didn't put them all on the table today. But seriously, thinking through about a modest public investment, I think in the long run would bring tremendous returns, because as we look at the landscape and we talk about water quality issues, in most cases, we do not have the real best management practices that can truly deal with water quality issues, carbon sequestration issues. I think that we have to look at in a new box of tools. So I think for a modest investment, public investment, that would in time bring in private capital would be the model that I would certainly think we ought to think about at least.
Any other questions? And Robes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, members, for coming in to testify. I apologize for being late. I was tied up with another issue. But I would just like to say that I have members from my district that are here. And actually, one of the premier scientists leading the way for America, and I think the world, in hazelnut research comes from my district. And that's Phil Rutter from Badgerset. And I've been out to his research station a number of times, and actually even before I was elected. And it's pretty amazing the amount of research that he's doing out there and hybridizing. And in fact, if I understand correctly, most of the hybrids and products you're using come directly from the Badgerset Research Center. So I just want to note for the record that Mr. Rutter is one of the premier developers of hazelnuts, and there's a tremendous opportunity for using them as not only nut meats and oils, but just a whole bunch of different products. And I also got to know Roy and Teresa Searling a few years ago, and I've been out to their farm, too, and seen how they're just getting started in hazelnut production. And the first time I heard about this probably was talking to Teresa. We got to know each other through the Minnesota State Horticultural Society, and I was writing an article on hazelnuts. And everybody said, well, hazelnuts? So, like, what's with that? And it's pretty amazing, the potential there. So I think Minnesota could easily be transformed into the Georgia pecan capital of the North with hazelnuts. So, I mean, there's tremendous opportunity here for us. So I want to acknowledge the folks in my district that are up here and give a big high ho for this initiative.
Well, Senator Ropes, how many times have you been out with your pail?
Well, Senator, actually, Phil Rutter showed me this great little pickup tool that he's invented that you can actually just roll it along. It's a big scooper basket that's better than the carry basket.
Well, next time you go out there, bring some. We can pass it around.
All right. Okay. There we go.
Okay. Anybody else? Any further questions? Not. Thank you very much. Thank you for keeping
thank you,
right
Senator
on
Beckerman.
Time. And
Senator Skolga.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Olson, we're going to skip around just a little bit. Senator Coring will take, or we can take Senator Coobley. We'll
ready for me?
You're going to wait.
Huh?
Senator Coobley's first.
I'm leaving at 5.
4 or 5?
Huh?
10 minutes, 2.
4:45.
Where are you going? Dinner.
That's kind
driving
of personal, isn't it?
I'm driving to snow. That's what I got to do here.
Senator Coobley, we're going to be picking up Senate Files 2756, anhydrous ammonia.
Betsy, can I talk to you?
Well, thank you, Ms. Chair and members. Senate File 2756 is just looking at changing some of the capacity that's used for the anhydrous nurse tanks And with me today is Ken DeBoer and Jeff Schmiesing from Westcon that is located in my district. I think the Department of Ag also has some suggestions, but I believe when we're finished with it, Mr. Chair and members, it needs to go to state and local government, is my understanding. So I think with that, we'll turn it over to our witnesses. One of you guys
want to go. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
My name is Ken DeBoer from Westcon Elevator, Holloway, Minnesota. I'm going to give you a little background on what we do out there. We're an anhydrous grain, or not anhydrous, but we're an agronomy grain co-op in western Minnesota, and we apply approximately 51 to 55,000 acres of custom applied anhydrous in the fall, mostly in the fall. And of those acres, about 75% of it are in Minnesota. So in the handout we have here is right around 38,000 plus acres that are applied in Minnesota at the rate of about 200 pounds per acre. And the way we do it now is we have 1,000-gallon tanks and some tanks that are a little bit larger than that. And each tank will cover approximately 20 acres when they're out in the field when they're putting on 200 pounds an acre. We have to pull the tanks from our main facility out to the field with pickups, and we figure each tank is pulled probably on the average about 20 miles, 10 miles out, 10 miles back, and that's a very conservative number. It's more than that, I'm sure, if we went and looked. It takes 15 minutes for an applicator to change tanks once he's out in the field. He has to unhook one tank, hook another one up. That entails not just hooking the hitch, but also hoses that are under pressure, get the pressure off, rehook them. And the applicator out there spends about 16 hours a day in the field, and in 16 hours he does approximately 300 acres, give or take, in a day. They do about 18¾ acres per hour out there. And under that scenario, we pull approximately 1,900 some tanks out to the field during that season. That's 38,000 some miles we put on with pickups. Those pickups are manned by seasonal help. They have to have hazmat endorsements to do that. And then each applicator spends about 3¾ hours per day just changing tanks. Okay. What we'd like to do to make the process safer, to speed it up, and to address our labor problem out there is to go to 5,000-gallon tanks in the field versus the 1,000. What that would do for us is each tank would cover 100 acres instead of 20 acres. And instead of having the product pulled out to the field in 1,000-gallon tanks with a pickup, we'd like to pull them out to the field in a semi-tractor transport configuration. And each tanker holds about 7,500 gallons. They hold enough in there to put on approximately 150 acres when they're out there. This would accomplish several things for us. One is in the safety portion of it. We anhydrous is inherently a dangerous product to handle, and we do a lot of training. We have a lot of safety mechanisms in place. Our fear is that with the seasonal help that we hire, that the training, as much as we do, at some point isn't going to be enough. And if we can go to 5,000-gallon tanks and we'll use our semi-tractor drivers, which are full-time employees, they're better trained. I think we can do that out in the field. Our safety factor is going to increase a lot for our employees. It will also increase our efficiency. We don't have to change tanks as often, so our operator, the tractor operator, can actually be applying fertilizer versus changing tanks. While he is putting more product in the tank that he's pulling with the 5,000-gallon tank, he can be doing maintenance on his machine or just taking a break. Versus the way it is right now, he's actually the one that changes the tanks out in the field, so he spends most of his time doing that and doesn't a lot of times have time to take breaks and so on. It would cut down in the number of miles that we would have somebody pulling out there. So tractor transport would spend about 5,100 miles versus the 38,000 that pickups spend on the road. It's a bigger tank that he's pulling, you know, but there's just less opportunity for rollovers or, you know, for accidents, those type of things. And the other benefit to us would be that we could put on more acres per day so we can serve our customers better at the same time. And that's all I have.
Okay. Well, next, Mr. Chair and members, we have Jeff Schmiesing, who works with the agronomy department there at the Westcon Co-op.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jeff Schmiesing. I'm the agronomy manager for Western Consolidated Co-op. Can give you a lot of good reasons, and I'm here more to give you some safety reasons that we should do this. You know, every day I've worked for this product for 30 years, and every year it's harder and harder to get good quality help in the fall. We go through a lot of training with our part-time people and our full-time people. But every year there's less and less population out in rural Minnesota, and it's getting harder and harder to find people. So that's probably another one of the reasons that we want to maintain this type of program. We're also going to eliminate a lot of small tanks off the road. A lot of the smaller tanks right now are more farm implement trailers. We want to like to go to more DOT-approved vehicles for pulling the product out in the field. We really feel by pulling all these small tanks off the roads will be a lot safer also. That's all I really got to add to it.
I think these men would be willing to take questions, Mr. Chair or members.
Senator Kubli, I just have a I'm just curious, and I look on the third picture in. My son's got a big tractor like that, too, but this is an 18-wheeler, if I'm looking at it right. And that big tank, that's kind of like a stationary. The tank sets in, and the last six wheels help hold that up.
Correct. That's the trailer that's pulled by the tractor. It's actually a trailer pulled by that tractor.
I'll just throw out a quiz question. What about the Department of Transportation? Do they object to big equipment like this? I'm just curious.
Well, Mr. Chair, the Transportation Committee certainly has the opportunity to ask for it. In fact, I thought that it would probably go there instead of state and local government, but state and local government has requested it, and the Transportation Committee has not as yet. But Senator Murphy has been pretty busy, so maybe he hasn't had an opportunity to look at it yet, but we can certainly go there following state and local if Senator Murphy would like to see it, and I can bring that to his attention too.
Well, Senator Kubli, maybe they don't want to see it, but it's a pretty good sized rig to go down the go down the road. But then I got neighbors that got into a combine 35-foot head, that takes up the whole road too, so you have to put carriers to. I'm just curious. Let's see.
Senator Engelbertson,
do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on that page as well. To understand that, then, somebody would deliver that tank with that sits on top of the six wheels there. Somebody else would deliver that to the field, or you would take your tractor in every time to reload it?
Josh Measing again, Senator, and the way we would do with that trailer, that'd be hooked up to the tractor at all times. We'd deliver the product to the field with a semi tanker.
So.
Follow up?
Yeah, I follow that. So this is not going to be out on the highway much at all.
Correct. It'll be in the field.
So that kind of answers your question there, too, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I didn't hear you. Maybe you mentioned it, but what are the rules in South Dakota on this?
We, I guess at this point, our plans are not to use this in South Dakota, so we really haven't talked to them about it yet. We're just, the majority of our night just goes on in Minnesota, so that's where we're planning on using them rigs.
Down in America.
Yeah, okay. And there are several other states that do this now. Kansas, Garden City Co-op in Kansas, the one that I've been conversing with, they've been using this type of an application rig for a number of years. Nebraska, I believe, is another one. I think Oklahoma also does it. And I've had heard, I don't know for sure, but I think Colorado does also.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, what does the law say right now in terms of capacity?
Kubley?
You're going to 5,000 gallons. What does it say now in current law?
Currently, right now, I believe, and we do, I got somebody from the state here, but right now, we just pull 1,000 or 1,500 gallon tanks, and we fill them in the town out of our local bullet. The law right now, you know, to be changed is we'd like to be able to go out the country and fill tanks out in the country that are greater than 3,000 but no more than 5,000.
Senator Dale.
Mr. Chairman, one of the witnesses, is it legal to pull 2,000-gallon tanks one behind the other?
I believe right now, Senator, you can pull them together if they are empty.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Dale, the department is here too. And they have some changes that they would like to work with us on as it moves to the next committee. And I think, you know, there would be time in between that to get some of those concerns addressed too. But the department is here. If you'd like to hear about those now, it's up to you.
Senator Kubley, they've asked to testify, so I want them to come up before.
All right.
Up there and slide another chair.
Well, maybe we could ask them to come up at this point, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bozicki, is that it? Help us out. First question I want you to what can you do right now? Is it 1,000?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Michael Ritchie. I'm a hazardous material specialist with MnDOT's Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations.
And, is a legal haul now 1,000-gallon tank?
Yes.
Okay. Let's hear what you think about 5,000 gallons.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the U.S. DOT hazmat transportation regulations govern all of this transport. U.S. DOT regulations, by federal law, have the authority to govern any hazmat transport inter or intrastate, including stuff that has to do with agriculture. The U.S. DOT has a regulation on anhydrous ammonia nurse tanks. Those are the tanks that the previous speakers were talking about as bullets. Nurse tanks by federal regulation are limited to 3,000-gallon capacity. Our main concern with this is if they want to go over 3,000 gallons, these tanks would not be considered nurse tanks under the federal regulations and would basically be fully regulated cargo tanks, just like the gasoline transport or propane transport going down the freeway. So right now they can haul 1,000-gallon tanks. The most common tanks are 1,000-gallon and 1,400-gallon tanks under these things, under the current regulations. They are allowed to haul behind a pickup truck to service a field one full tank. They can bring two empties back behind a pickup truck based on state law in Chapter 169.
And Mr. Chair.
Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I regret that I overlooked the amendment that I have that brings that into compliance with what the department is talking about here. It's the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair, and it should be in members' packets.
Just wait a minute, Senator Kubley, till we get them passed out.
All right. Well, maybe I could talk about the amendment a little bit.
Go ahead and talk about it.
Yeah, you know, it's just an addition to this bill that would bring it into compliance with the U.S. Department of Transportation's requirements, that have already been talked about.
Okay. Senator Kubley, would you like to move this amendment?
I would, Mr. Chair. I'll move the A1 amendment to Senate File 2756 be adopted.
Senator Kubley moves that Senate File A-1 be incorporated into his bill to get his bill the way he would like to have it. Is that fair to say?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now your bill is in order, Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have more that you
want. Now,
very briefly.
Okay, we'll go back to the witness, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the draft language for the amendment basically would incorporate the USDOT's hazmat transportation regulations as far as use of specification cargo tanks for any tank bigger than 3,000 gallons, the DOT's regulations on the loading and offloading of these, the attendance of the vehicles, there's requirements for that. And so basically we're comfortable with this amendment because it references federal law that it's already in effect just based on the federal law and the federal rules and could be considered incompatible if we didn't have that kind of reference in it. And if it's incompatible, it's one of those things the USDOT comes and makes noises about taking away highway funding because we have laws that are not consistent with federal laws that are required to be consistent.
Any other questions? Senator Kubley, worried about the men down in the roads, but I see you've got Senator Langseth, who knows more about roads probably than I do. Senator Scogin is getting knowledge, and Senator Murphy, so they must have looked at this, and Senator Scoy, too.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair and Senator Kubley, what I'm understanding here is if this passes, the anhydrous will be transported in a truck as opposed to a nurse tank, which seems to be safer. To me, it does. I mean, I haven't thought through how they're going to move this thing around from field to field and if it's going to be full or empty when they're going from farm to farm. You know, which, you know, you might want to think about what's going on there. But, I mean, generally, it appears like the movement of the anhydrous will be safer in a truck transport than in those nurse tanks that I use.
It would seem that way to me, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy.
Yeah, the only question that I have in my mind is when this tractor unit is moving from farm to farm, whether it be full or empty, but I'm understanding here with this amendment that you put on, this tank now is going to be dealt with the same regulation as a transport truck.
That's correct, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy.
Seemed reasonable.
Any other? Sir?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Greg Bozicki from the Department of Agriculture. And we've briefly talked with Senator Kubley. We've been talking with some of with Westcon. In the bill, in the original bill in Section 1, there's a reference to rules imposing appropriate safety and environmental safeguards, and that's what we'd like to explore a little bit more with Senator Kubley. That's good that that's in there. What we would like to do is just see if we want to look at a permit process, perhaps, or something like that, and possibly define that more. We understand the intent and the benefits of this that we've talked with Westcon, so I think we're all in agreement that we want to make sure that we have a safe process. This would go, the concerns that we would have is right now, nurse tank filling by law takes place at fixed facilities. Those would be the co-ops and so forth. By doing the filling in the field, we'd want to make sure that we're doing it appropriately and safely, and that's basically what we're interested in doing. And Senator Kubley is certainly concerned about that as well, so we know. So,
and we do have a little time, Mr. Chair. So, you know, I think it's got at least one more committee stop, and I think logically two. So I think we have time to work with the department to get the changes that would take a look at some of those safety issues.
I think you have to realize that agriculture is changing. They're all getting big farms. Down in my area, most farmers got 2,000 and 3,000, maybe 4,000 acres versus we used to have 160. So things are getting bigger. The equipment's getting bigger. That isn't a big tractor. I can find those tractors all over where I live, big John Deere triple duals. So it is a plus, and we're trying to make agriculture the most profitable business you can get into. So any little thing we can do to help cut the cost is worthwhile. Senator Engelbretson.
Mr. Chair, I agree, but I'd also like the comment that we need to really look at where you're going to be loading these things. Should you have soft ground? Should you have damp weather? Most generally, I think the truck would probably be driven into the field to load. If you start having trouble with that and loading them up on the highway would be
an issue you should really be looking at and, you know, paying attention to.
Senator Engelbrechtson, I'd have a little trouble with some of our township roads because all that's a little ditch, and we can work all that out. Any other discussion? If not, Senator Coobley, this is going to have to go to state and local government. You're aware of that.
I am, Mr. Chair. And if the committee is ready, I would move that Senate File 2756 be recommended to pass and sent to state and local government policy.
Senator Coobley moves that Senate File 2756 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to state and local government. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Is he in a hurry? Okay. Senator Coobley, maybe you want to pick up your next bill of...
That'd be fine, Mr. Chair. We've got a few testifiers here as well. Senate File 2405, Mr. Chair, deals with an exemption from state income tax for military retirees who move to the state. Currently, Minnesota does not really have even an average number of retirees who come to the state when they retire from active military service. And there are quite a number of states that have an exemption or a partial exemption. And I guess the bill before you today, while some of the testimony is being passed out, Mr. Chair, would simply allow for a partial exemption to the retirees who moved to Minnesota. I guess what we tried to do is cover the retirement benefits that a non-commissioned officer would receive. You know, we're not sure that the upper brass would probably need this kind of an exemption. You know, I told former Senator Johnson that probably a one-star general doesn't need an exemption of his retirement pay, and he agreed. So, you know, I think we're trying to target those who do not have a real high retirement income and try and help them out a bit here instead of, you know, offering blanket coverage that gives the same benefit to every dollar of retirement income. But with me today are a number of people. We've got one of the commissioners here from the department, and Ms. Wazereski from Renville County is the VSO there, and so we appreciate their coming and their willingness to visit with the committee.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Michael Puglisi, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm the Deputy Commissioner. I just wanted to take a moment to lend our support towards this bill. We think it's a great step forward, although we would like to see 100% exemption of costs. We think this is a great initial step. I know this bill has been before the committee a few times. I think Senator Coobley laid the argument out quite well. I know the veteran community is very supportive of this bill. They also would like to see 100% exemption. As I said, I think this is a great first step, and I'm open for any questions that the committee members may have.
Any questions, Mr. Brzezinski? Let's hear from your next list.
Yes, good afternoon, Chairman Vickerman and members of the committee, and I'd like to thank Senator Coobley for inviting me from the corn capital out east here to the state capitol to testify today. My name is Roberta Wazurski, and I am the County Veterans Service Officer in Renville County, and I do work with retirees. So what I've done today is I've gotten some testimony together here of how my experience with retirees out in Renville County. My office averages 14 calls a year from military personnel that are interested in moving back to the area after retirement. They all ask about the Minnesota tax policy of their military retirement. The majority of these retirees are between the ages of 39 to 45 years of age and are ready to start a second career. And the majority of them have children that are still in school, and the majority of them are interested in buying homes and settling down. When they hear that Minnesota taxes their military pension, most of them do not come here. Most settle in a state that does not tax their military retirement or at least has some kind of tax break for their military pension. I did have one family move retire from the United States Navy, and they moved to Olivia
in the late 90s. That retiree worked as an electrician, had two children in the local public school. They also bought a home. After 4 years, they decided to relocate to Wisconsin because they would not be taxed on their retirement pay. It was a loss to our community. I just had a phone call actually yesterday from a retiree that's out in Montana who inquired about taxes. He's thinking about moving home to Fairfax. He will retire as an E-7. But he said he could not afford to come back if the state is going to tax his military retirement. He told me to keep him posted. I told him what we were doing today. I'm going to talk mainly about enlisted retirees because out in the rural area, that's the majority of retirees that I work with. Just to fill you in, if we would have a staff sergeant, E-6, retire from the Army today at their present pay, his annual retirement would be $20,539. If that retiree was an E-7, he would retire today and have an income of $23,000 annually. An E-8 or a first sergeant would retire today with current pay scale would have a retirement income of $28,845 annually. If these retirees moved back here, bought homes, worked, and put their children in schools, they're well worth the tax exemption. And I know Renville County could certainly use an influx of some of these people. They would be productive individuals that would pay taxes and be an important asset to the communities they settle in with their second careers. I also have a guard unit in Olivia. And this guard unit was deployed to Iraq, and they've been home for 2 years. I have a guard retiree that just retired a few years ago. He served 38 years with the Minnesota National Guard. He was never activated to war, but I remember him going off to many floods in southwest Minnesota. He attended all his drills, and he put in his 2 weeks of training all those years. He retired a few years ago as an E-6, and his retirement income is $7,920 a year. And, yes, the state of Minnesota taxes that, even though he served for 38 years, and he did not collect pay until after age 60. I think we owe this soldier more than that. Our local guard units served in Iraq, and since they returned 2 years ago this November, I've had two of them retire. They will not collect their pay until age 60, and then it will be right around an average of $10,000 a year. We should not tax this after they served the state and the nation for more than 20 years. And most dear to my heart, and I take care of veterans daily, is also from the recent war and from all the wars. I've got Vietnam veterans, World War II veterans. I just had a World War II veteran pass away that are medically retired. And these veterans were found unfit for military service due to an injury that they got while they were in the military. Two that are retired right now are both E-4s. They retired last year when the military finally got them well enough to find them unfit for duty. One served with our guard unit in Iraq. He is an amputee. He is an E-4, a specialist, so he gets half that pay, and he's collecting $980 a month retirement, and we tax that. The other soldier spent two tours in Iraq. He was active duty. His home was Renville County. He has since returned home. His second deployment, he was with the 101st Airborne Division. He is medically retired due to post-traumatic stress disorder. He's unable to work. This veteran collects $1,013 a month, and we tax that. These soldiers went to war from here. They had no choice. They had to retire. They couldn't stay longer to retire in E-6, E-7, and E-8. They were found unfit duty due to war injuries they received, and they certainly aren't not to get rich over this retirement. The majority of medically retired that I work with from my county are in the enlisted ranks. I just had a World War II veteran that passed away. I met him almost 18 years ago. He was medically retired as a PFC, and after all those years, he was collecting $5,960 a year in the year 2007 when he passed away. I think the bullets he took in Europe is all that he should have had to pay for that. And to give you a few more examples, I know an E-8, a first sergeant, that retired in 1990. This retired soldier started a second career and has held down a county job for almost 18 years. This retiree works to help veterans and military personnel daily. This retiree has raised two children that started in kindergarten and first grade in the Olivia school system. This retiree has served on the school board, belonged to several service organizations, bought a house, served in the local economic development, is an active member in a local church, serves as a volunteer in the community, has educated a daughter in the Minnesota State College system, and is putting this same daughter through for her master's degree at Hamline University. This retiree has a son that just returned from a hardship tour overseas, and his wife is graduating with a double major from St. Thomas College this May. He talked about coming home to Minnesota to recruit, but this retiree told him not to because this state will tax him if he's stationed inside the state boundaries of Minnesota. He's now stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington, and when his wife graduates in May, she will head there to start her career. His active duty pay will not be taxed as long as he's not stationed in Minnesota. These two would have been a great asset to any community in the state of Minnesota. I hope that by the time he retires at the age of 40, he'll be able to retire back here and start a second career and move his family back to Minnesota and come home. This E8 I'm talking about is getting ready to retire eventually from the second career and is seriously thinking about heading out to another state, either directly east or west, due to the fact that the retirement pay will not be taxed. This retiree I'm talking about received a grand total of $19,716 in the year 2007 from military retirement pay, and I believe that retiree is well worth that, what they've done in the community. I do believe that this is a good bill. It won't take care of a lot of retirees, but it's certainly a wonderful start, and what a way to make a difference. This way, everyone will be treated equally, and I believe that the $15,000 exemption will make a difference, and more retirees will settle in the state, and more retirees will stay in the state. Their presence here in the state of Minnesota and all they contribute will more than outweigh the $15,000 exemption. I thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Senator Cornyn.
Well, thank you, Mr. I'm just wondering if Senator Kubley has a fiscal note on this bill. I know we're probably just deciding whether or not this is good policy in here, but I guess I'd be interested to know if you had a fiscal note and how much it's going to cost. Can I ask that?
What is in the packet?
No, there is a fiscal note, Senator. Well, we do have a couple of other witnesses, Mr. Chair and members. And we thank the commissioner. One of these days I'm going to be able to learn to pronounce his name. And he's already learned ours, so. Next, we have Marv Garvey from Montevideo and I forgot your first name, Merlin Ellefson from Dawson.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Chairman Vickerman, committee. My name is Marvin E. Garvey. I'm a retired Chief Warrant Officer W-4. By the pleasure of the governor, about a year ago, they gave me an honorary degree of a brevet CW-5, which I'm very thankful for. Didn't affect my retired pay, though.
Those honorary degrees.
That's right, honorary. I am a retiree having served 37-plus years with the Minnesota Army National Guard. I worked for them full-time for 30 years. I spent many nights and weekends serving both our state and nation. I have no regrets, but I did miss the birth of our second daughter and our third child, a son. There were many times I was not home for birthdays, anniversaries, funerals, and etc. Since retirement, I moved back to Montevideo after living in the St. Paul area for 9 years, just working down the street here at the National Guard Armory. I was again elected as city council, now serving on my 22nd year, worked part-time as a jailer dispatcher, and I'm currently the Chippewa County Emergency Management Director, a position I've held for 8 years. I'm president of the Montevideo Economic Development Authority, vice president of the Montevideo Planning Commission, and currently commander of American Legion Post 59 in Montevideo. So in retirement, I still provide, a vital part to the community. I would invite you to read the enclosed article from Lieutenant Colonel Morris, chaplain with the Minnesota Army National Guard. It appeared February 24, 2008 in the Sunday St. Paul Pioneer Press. Although it does not talk about retirees, it addresses the type of service members that we have in this state. They have given the best years of their life in defense of the state and nation, and in many cases have given their lives. We cannot lose these individuals to other states, that allow benefits to those who are still serving or retired. I have also included a chart from the Military Officer magazine that appeared in the January 2008 edition. It shows 25 states that give various tax incentives to military retirees. Our neighboring state to the east, Wisconsin, exempts all retired pay, and South Dakota to the west has no state income tax. I have worked alongside members of the United States Army Reserve at Fort Snelling and with active components at various military installations in the States and in Japan. We cannot afford to lose these highly trained and motivated individuals to other states. They have many years left to contribute to our many businesses and industrial firms. They contribute to their local communities by serving on city councils, as county commissioners, on school boards, and various service organizations, just to list a few. The small loss in taxes for the $15,000 exemption retired pay would be replaced tenfold in their contribution to our business climate and serving their communities. These service members show up for work each day, are on time, and understand commitment to their employer and to their community. I appreciate that we have a shortfall in state revenues. We may have prevented this if these highly educated and qualified retirees had stayed in the state. We must also realize that our active duty service members look at where they will locate when they retire. They check out states that offer something back to the service of their country. We lose the opportunity of them selecting our state as their new home and future employment. In most cases, these retirees are in their early 40s and have many years left to contribute. I ask that you give this serious consideration and do right by those who protect our great state and nation. Thank you for allowing me to testify. God bless America and God bless Minnesota. Thank you.
Very much. Kubi, our next witness. Mr. Ellison will testify.
My name is Merlin Ellison. I'm from Dawson, Minnesota. I live in Dawson with my wife, Jane, and we own a home there. I'm also the mayor of our town of about 1,500 people. I joined the National Guard in 1956. I was still a senior in high school. And it was a thing to do. I think about half of my class joined. And at that time, basic training was optional. I chose to go in winter 57, 58. And during the first years with the National Guard, we attended Monday night drills. That was every Monday night. And we were paid quarterly. I think my first paychecks were about $120 for the quarter. So we kind of a volunteer organization, I guess. I did retire as a first sergeant in 1999 after serving just 3 days short of 43 years. After all those years of service, I still am not eligible for VA benefits because I was never activated. My basic training, they cut a short 3 days, I believe, short of 181 days. So I'm not eligible for VA benefits. For a while during all those years, the state of Minnesota saw fit to allow at least a portion of our military earnings to be exempt from state taxes, and then that abruptly ended. And I'm asking that you consider exempting military retired pay from state income taxes. Minnesota is only one of a few remaining states that still tax or pay. Veterans who are receiving retirement pay volunteer to serve their state and country. With many retired veterans, their volunteering has continued after their retirement, which is a big asset to our communities, counties, and state. Enlisted retirees receive considerably less retirement than retired officers. Nonetheless, it is a supplement to their retirement income. We all know living on Social Security alone isn't a wholesome life, and they have tough times. Yes, some do make it, but meeting their living expenses is getting harder and harder. I know of a married couple who both retired from the National Guard and promptly moved to a southern state because of the income tax. A retired CSM who worked right here in St. Paul moved to South Dakota to avoid the tax. We are losing people who would spend those dollars here. And you know how every dollar spent here adds to the economy. Any inroads in this area will serve as an encouragement to continue to live in Minnesota once a military member retires. Again, I urge you to enact legislation to exempt retired military pay from Minnesota income taxes and keep our retired military living in our great state. Thank you for your consideration.
Any questions? Do you have anybody else, Senator Cooley? Or Senator Engelbart?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that testimony. The part that you said that at one time there was military pay that was exempt, and then it was taken away. Can you tell me a little more about that, or somebody know?
I forget
that?
What years that was, but they exempted up to $3,000 of your pay.
Ms. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think that's about 18 years ago now.
And that was just pay that we earned while we were members of the National Guard or the military. Retired pay was never considered at that time. We just picked up things that we made during the year.
But, well, Ms. Chair and members, too, I guess I'd like to mention that the average state in this country has about 32,000 retired veterans. Whether you use the Revenue Department's number on the fiscal note or whether you use the number that has been mentioned by other veterans groups, we're still significantly short of the number of retired veterans that the average state has. And it does seem like that something like this would really cover the costs on its own by the time you bring these folks into the state and they're working other jobs. They're law-abiding citizens. They're better than average employees. I mean, there are just a lot of positives going for them. So as we consider this, Ms. Chair, I'd like to just share some brief words with you that I've seen before, but to remind ourselves that it's the veteran, not the preacher, that's given us freedom of religion, not freedom from religion, but freedom of. It's the veteran, not the reporter, who's given us freedom of the press. The veteran, not the writer, who's given us the freedom of speech. The veteran, not the organizer, who's given us the freedom to assemble. The veteran, not the attorney, who's given us the right to a fair trial. The veteran, not the politician, who's given us the right to vote. It is the veteran who not only salutes the flag, but serves under the flag. And it seems to me, Mr. Chair and members, that we can do this small piece for our veterans and offer some competitive nature for the service members who have admirably served from the state of Minnesota and would like to return here to live out their retirement years. Thank you.
Any more from your witnesses, Mr. Cooper? I'm thirsty. Then I have somebody from the audience, but if that's all you have there?
That's all that I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Come on up. Anybody else from the audience want to testify? Come up. I need your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Kaiser. I'm the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council, and we represent the 402,000 veterans plus in the state of Minnesota. Of course, our objective is to lobby the legislature to make Minnesota more veteran-friendly. And I applaud the senator for putting this forward. It's a start. We have been pushing this forward for a number of years. The veterans initiatives that are out there right now are what we're working on, and we applaud you, sir, for all the for the efforts this is. I couldn't say any more than what these ladies and gentlemen have already said, and the fact that the United Veterans Legislative Council does support this greatly, and we hope that this is a start. We'd like to see 100%, but we have to start somewhere, and we appreciate you considering this to get it going to the next level of whatever it needs to be. So, very much.
Any other questions? I don't think there's one person here that don't agree with what we should do, but so we're going to have to take a look at the big picture. And that's, we'll only handle our veterans part in here. The tax committee is going to have to figure out the rest of it. But if we think it's a good idea, and I certainly do, that we should do some subtraction. And you know, just because we're $1 billion short, I've been there before. Almost four and five. So if we really want to find the money, want to find the help, we can do it. This is a very friendly Veterans Committee, and we try to do the very best we can. And so, Senator Coobley, if you have nobody else.
Okay. Well, thank you for those kind words, Mr. Chair. I'd move that Senate File 2405 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Senator Coobley moves that Senate File 2405 be recommended to pass and be referred to Taxes. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you very much, sir.
Senator Coring, are you ready?
Get going.
All right, let's get on TV.
Sure, yes.
Mr. Chairman, I am ready. This should only take about 5 minutes.
Yeah,
you have before you Senate File 2327, and I actually I'm kind of looking to the committee and Mr. Knopf especially for some guidance, because I was actually kind of looking at it beforehand. And first of all, I'm going to read you a letter. And this is a letter that I received from a constituent of mine, and it reads like this. My name is Jesse Ray, and I was honorably discharged from the Navy a year ago. I grew up in Brainerd. During my time in the service, I met my wife, and we moved back here after I got out. She was from Connecticut. Due to Statute 136A-101, subsection 8, she was not eligible for state-funded grants or financial aid. According to this, she was considered... would be considered a resident student upon moving to the state if the spouse has maintained residency during the time in the service. And so what I'm trying to do is make it so that this person and other people that come back here are able to get resident tuition and grants. And if you look at the language that I have, it says a spouse or dependent of a veteran as defined under Section 197.447 if the veteran is a Minnesota resident. Now, my problem is if you look at number 6, and then if you go back and you look at, I don't know if you have number 5. Do you have number 5? If you have number 5, my question is kind of to Mr. Knopf. Does number 5 kind of take care of my problem or not exactly? No?
Mr. Knopf, or one of you two. Tom,
handle it. Mr. Chairman and Senator Coring, number 5 takes care of spouses or dependents of individuals who are on active federal military service, and number 6 is extended to veterans. So those are people who have formerly been in active military service as defined under 197.447.
And so, Mr. Chairman, if I can ask another question. If you look at number 1, it says a student who has resided in Minnesota for purposes other than post-secondary education for at least 12 months. So his wife has to be here for at least 12 months before she'd be eligible for any grants or anything
Mr.
of that
Chairman
nature.
And Senator Coring, these are in the disjunctive. You can satisfy any one of them and then be a resident student. So simply meeting the requirements of 6, as I read this, would satisfy...
6 months?
Yes. You wouldn't need to be more than one of these items.
Well, it'd be my preference that we... I'm not... completely satisfied with this. I'm not sure if this is taking care of what I want to take care of or if it's just being redundant, but I'd like to have this committee pass it out, and then when it goes to Senator Pappas's committee, between there and here and there, I want to try to figure out if I even need this and call my constituent again and try to figure out if this is what I want. So I'm sorry about seemingly being unprepared, but while I was sitting here, I started to do a little homework and just not quite sure. So,
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Coring, you are doing something different in 6 than there is in 5, but
But, Mr. Bonner, my question is more, maybe I misunderstood Senator Coring. If the gentleman lived here and then got married and his wife moved here, or they both moved here? I didn't get that real
well,
clear.
Well, the way I understand it, it says, my name is Jesse Ray, honorably discharged from the Navy a year ago. I grew up in Brainerd during my time in the service. So he was away. He was in active military service, the way it sounds. I met my wife. We moved back here. When we got out, she's from Connecticut. So then when they moved back here, I suppose he was away maybe for a couple, 2-3 years. It doesn't say that in here. But then when he got back here, she was not eligible for any, they're going to Central Lakes College, not eligible for any state grants or financial aid at all because she's
non-resident.
Somebody's here to testify. I don't know if it's for or against, but I hope it's for.
It's merely to explain.
Okay.
Maybe.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Tim Med. I'm with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, who administers this law. You're correct. The veteran spouse, because she has moved to Minnesota, it's the interpretation that she has to live here 12 months. Like any other spouse that would move to Minnesota. This law would take care, this amendment would take care of that issue.
It would.
Yeah. Okay. And we also did a little paperwork on our little, got a little information. Right now there are 490 state grant recipients who are both married and veterans. And of these, only 162 have a family size with the number of in college greater than one. So it's a real limited number of people who would be affected by this, and most of these are already residents anyway. This is a $156 million program per year is what we spent on at least last year. And we estimate this, putting this amendment in, might cost $16,000 to maybe $100,000. So...
$6,200?
$16,000 to $100,000. Oh, we can afford that, can't we?
it's not a lot.
Okay. Okay.
Well, Mr.
All right.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Bodden. The grant has a ceiling amount, though, so it would be just that they qualify for the dollars that are already there. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, I'm certainly not the expert here. That's kind of more of a higher ed matter. You may want to consult with a witness on that, but this would make them eligible for benefits that the resident student can obtain and whatever
right.
limits that's subject to.
Well, Mr. Chair, then to the witness, it is a limited pool of money, so they would just hop into the pool with everyone else that's in it, but it wouldn't create an additional cost. It would just be...
Well, there would be a slight additional cost to the state because right now this person we're talking about is not eligible to receive state grant money. She is eligible to receive resident tuition.
Appropriation is not open.
But so there would be an additional cost to the state, but I think it would certainly be less than $100,000 a year.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, but isn't it a limited appropriation? Everybody has to fit within that appropriation.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Wergen.
Senator Wergen.
Sorry.
Okay.
There's an appropriation each year from the legislature. We always have money left over and have to return it. And sometimes we get yelled at for returning too much. Our agency's position is that this we're neither for or against, but this would cost about $100,000. It'd be that much less we'd return to the state general fund.
Mr. Chair, it would seem like we should pass this on to the Higher Education Committee because it certainly sounds reasonable. It isn't something that's going to make that much difference. And let that committee decide whether this is appropriate or not. So I would make the motion. I guess Senator Cornyn could make the motion, too, for that matter.
Senator Scoy, you want to say something first?
Well, I was going to say the same thing that Senator Langseth did, that this is a higher ed matter. I think that the money that the witness was referring to that the state grant doesn't spend. I think it goes into the living LME or whatever they call it now, but I think you should send it to higher ed and let them sort it out.
You guys think it's a- Any other questions? Senator Langseth moves that Senate File 2327 be recommended to pass, and we have to send it to Finance first, and then they send it. All right? And they will send it to High Rate. That's the rule, I guess. So that's where to go to Finance first, and that's just a trip to move on. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted. We have one last piece. That's Senator Holton.
Take it out of here.
What? Well, we just spent
our welcome to the committee. And
a lot of money.
A lot of money.
We're broke. But if you want to proceed.
Okay, see ya. Mr. Chair, members, it's my pleasure to be here before you today on Senate File.
What?
Senate File 2840, and this is a bill about National Guard Youth Challenge Program, and this is a study that would allow the – oh, actually, I have to say, there's supposed to be a Colonel Alness from the Minnesota National Guard sitting here, but he's in Washington, D.C., so I'm winging this myself. So.
Somebody else.
Welcome to this.
Just got help. Reinforcements.
Good. I will just do a quick overview and then turn it over. Because this is, members, this seems like a program that might be a way to help kids that kind of fall through the cracks. National Guard's doing this, I think, in like 28 states, and they've trained like 77 kids. It's kind of like boot camp type of a thing, only it's not quite so physical as my understanding, but it gives a chance for kids that have dropped out of school age 16 to 18 to get a chance. I believe they earn their GED. But with that, I think I'll turn it over to somebody who can really tell you the story.
Welcome to committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Don Kerr, and I'm a new employee of the Department of Military Affairs, and I'm stepping in for Colonel Alness today, who is in Washington, D.C., with the congressional delegation. So this is, of course, as stated, a bill to direct the National Guard to study whether or not this would be a cost-effective and effective program in Minnesota, and also to identify where it might be conducted. And the agency has no opinion on that, but we will provide information to you. But we will tell you that it is a National Guard 60-40 funded program, so there is some federal dollars that could flow to this. We are not currently conducting this in Minnesota. We don't exactly know what the ramifications are, but we have done a fiscal note for the House Companion Bill that indicates that for us to move forward, we estimate it would cost about $18,000 to do the study, and that should be with the file. If not, it's available in the House Companion Bill. Challenges the Resident Military Academy program. The intent is to set up a long-term program that runs two cycles a year. As we've looked at some other states, we've identified that it is a National Guard responsibility in those states to identify candidates for the program. And so that would be an additional task for the National Guard should we implement the full program. But it is also a very successful program in other states as well. And it is, as stated, a boot camp-like program that provides some discipline and leadership training to challenged youth.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I know some. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know some people have expressed concerns to me about, you know, is this just a tool for the National Guard to get more soldiers in the National Guard? And I don't think the statistics rule show that. I think the number that I've seen is that the graduates in the program are, it's like 96% graduate and with the GED, and they go on to the world of work or higher ed, and 80% graduate with the GED, 96% go on to, you know, become, I guess, well-adjusted adults. So the program has some pretty good history to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was I'm a co-author on this bill, and I was just reading through the pamphlet here, waiting for Senator Holcein, and this reminds me of a lot of the efforts we're going through right now in the healthcare field. We're trying to look at ways to cut costs. And we also do this in education. And we've realized if you put money into early childhood education, then you fix some problems so the kids are young so that you don't have long-term continuing problems. The same thing we're talking about right now in healthcare. If we do preventative care and keep people healthy and well, then we save money from the long-term sickness and chronic illnesses that cost so much money. And this seems to be an example of that kind of program where we deal with challenged youth, at-risk youth early. And I'm looking here, they need to be volunteers between the age of 16 and 18 that have dropped out of school and are unemployed. And these kids are just floating right now. And they list some statistics here that are pretty startling. It says more than 1 million young Americans between 16 and 19 drop out of school before they get the life skills and the training that they need to survive. And a typical day sees over 5,000 young men and women under the age of 18 arrested. So this is a perfect example of if we don't take care of these kids when they're still young and we can run them through some of these programs, the judicial system is going to be winding up picking up a big cost. So I think it's a great intervention.
Any other questions? Senator Olsen, do you have any? Senator
Scully? Well, Mr. Chair, does Senator Olsen need a motion on this, or where are we headed?
I was going to head for the floor, but I can't go to the floor when you said $22,000, so now I'm going to have to go to finance, and they can figure out whether I'm going to. Am I right? Senator?
Mr. Chair, this bill came to us as a policy bill directly from the floor, so now that we know that there's a fiscal note attached to it, we have to pass it to finance, and then they'll kick it back to us as a budget division.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 2840 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee.
Everybody understand the questions? Senator Scoia moves that Senate File 2840 be recommended to pass and refer to the Finance Committee. Any further discussion? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
So adopted, members. I think that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members.
Thank you for your patience today. We're adjourned.
Sorry.